Have you found the rhythm yet? As we come to the end of this fall series, it feels appropriate that we ask, have we found our rhythm? We've covered a lot of important aspects of life in this series. We've been trying to find the rhythm between rest and work, in our public and our private lives, the rhythm between worship and witness, the present and the future, the rhythm between thinking and acting and loving our own and loving others, and the rhythms of our body and soul. And again, we ask, have you found your rhythm yet? I've been asking that myself. For instance, when it comes to work and rest, I found myself fighting the feeling of being overwhelmed with the many added layers of responsibility in ministry that we're experiencing in this pandemic. Like countless other jobs, all of our responsibilities were full prior to the pandemic, and now they feel even more so. And yet we need to rest and seek Sabbath, maybe now more than ever before. I won't lie to you and say here at the end of this series, I've achieved this perfect work-rest rhythm. But I tell you, I really enjoy being part of a faith community that acknowledges the incredible need for this. For years, I've tried to practice aspects of Sabbath keeping, and I've had good stretches and some poor ones. And the truth is, I never quite feel rested enough. And as a pastor and as a fellow worshiper, I want to be a part of a church that doesn't work each other to death and that doesn't guilt each other on Sabbath keeping. And more so, that is preaching on the importance of finding rhythm between work and rest. I need that. I crave that. And so whether it's been about work and rest or other topics like thinking and acting or thinking about the future and living in the present or punting on the consequences of the future and only thinking about the present moment and various other topics that have come up, I've actually regularly found myself whispering to myself, I need to find the rhythm here. Maybe you've been whispering something similar. Today, as we wrap up this series, we want to acknowledge that there are countless other rhythms that need to be found in life. And so what do we do when we discover that we need to find these new rhythms? Can I share with you one of the rhythms that I'm trying to figure out as we approach the holidays and family gathering season? In fact, it's a rhythm that I've been trying to figure out for quite some time, regardless of the season. And that is that tension when it comes to having important conversations about our world, about our society, about our families, about our beliefs and convictions, whether they cover politics or culture or current news events. I'm just trying to make sense of it all. Often I find this tension of trying to be nice and also wanting to say things like it is. For instance, I have this group of friends that I hang out with regularly. And we have different faith traditions and different backgrounds. And we seem to not want to talk about serious issues. And as soon as a serious issue comes up, there's usually some type of a pivot or an escape out of it. And the truth is, I want to know what they think. They're smart. I trust them. I want to hear their thoughts, and I know that we'll have disagreements, and that's why I'm asking. So we can help understand more and more from various perspectives to help inform our own perspectives. I feel that tension, and I need some type of a relational rhythm here. Naturally, as Christ followers, we look to Jesus for the answer. And here's one key observation we're going to make today. Jesus lived a life with a rhythm of grace and truth. In fact, the Gospel of John sets up the story of Jesus like this. It says, "The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." Just like Jesus, we need to be full of grace and truth. I know some of you might be thinking right now, oh no, here we go again, another sermon about being a better person, about being nicer, being more graceful, more honest, more truthful. No, that's not really what I mean. Up front, I want to be really clear on two things. That's not what this is going to be about. And more so, Christianity is not about just being nice In fact, Jesus' core message is not actually to be a better person. It's about being a forgiven person in the eyes of God, to be a gospel-rooted and sent person, just like how Jesus was. It's hardly about just being nice. I think I found somewhat of an appropriate metaphor for what I'm not describing today. And it comes from our dear friends at Chick-fil-A. I love Chick-fil-A. But there's this wonderful comedian that has a bit where he acts out three different roles at a local Chick-fil-A restaurant. And the sketch starts off with a manager at the Chick-fil-A saying to his employees that there's a shortage of dipping sauces and they're going to limit one dipping sauce per customer. So one of the employees rightfully asks, people are going to be mad about that. What do we tell them? Tell them this. It'll be my pleasure to inform you that I can only give you one dipping sauce. Well, as you can imagine, as soon as a customer begins to give that order and they start listing the various dipping sauces that they want, they have to be interrupted by the brave Chick-fil-A worker, and he has to explain, I'm sorry, sir, due to shortages, only one dipping sauce per order. It's my pleasure to give you only one. And so the sketch has like this back and forth between the customer arguing, I want more than one dipping sauce. I want the honey mustard. I want the special Chick-fil-A sauce. I want the spicy sauce. And then the poor employee has to continue saying, my pleasure. I'm sorry, sir. And everything is my pleasure, my pleasure, my pleasure. Even if it's not the right context. My pleasure. My pleasure has become the new code for saying what you're supposed to say, but don't really feel. I mean, I feel for these Chick-fil-A workers who have to say my pleasure 1,000 times an hour just because you're thanking them for a napkin or a ketchup. My pleasure. My pleasure. My pleasure. Now, please go. I mean, excuse me. No, my pleasure. Maybe you don't say those words exactly, but there are countless other euphemisms for this. Absolutely. Yes. Anytime. Call me anytime. Always there. 100 others. Grace and truth isn't about summoning up the strength to give an undeserved pleasantry. That's insincere. Now, Chick-fil-A is leading a food service business that majors on customer satisfaction, and they're doing an extraordinary job. But that's not what our lives are about. And that's not what I'm talking about. I'm concerned that we've diluted the beauty and the power of grace and just reduced it to just about being nice. And in regards to truth, I wonder if we have undermined its love and virtue and reduced it to just tell it like it is. And sometimes we avoid saying what we really mean altogether just to avoid a conflict. And if we are not careful, these could be either lazy or dangerous reductions of important things. They could be both, they could be worse, but it's not helpful. And so instead, this is what we mean when we talk about grace. Grace is the redemptive work that only God can do. And truth is the message of a kingdom reality, the one that Jesus brings. The gospel writer John gives us this lens to see Jesus in the coming stories of grace and truth. And he unpacks this lens of grace and truth so we can kind of see these things in the stories in the coming chapters of chapter 2 and 3 and so forth. Now, a quick word on the writer John here. John isn't interested in the chronology of Jesus' story. He is more interested in telling you certain features and certain conversations, illustrating signs and specific words and concepts in this story that he's trying to tell. Let me help you further. The other gospel writers, like Matthew, who's a tax collector, he wants to be accurate. Luke, a doctor, his life is about accuracy. It's part of his calling. Mark prides himself on creating an account that was early and accurate. John, the best way to explain John is that John is an artist. When you really start comparing the gospel accounts to each other, and as you try to get a sense on what the other writers are doing, when it comes to John, you say things like, that's really great, but why is it there like that? Well, it's because he's an artist. We all have that one artistic friend, right? Give them space. Let them create. We're going to revisit this again. But similar to how a few weeks ago, Pastor Leah took us on a tour of a day in the life of Jesus from Mark chapter 1, we're going to take a quick tour of a few stories in the coming chapters as we see Jesus living out this life of rhythm, of being full of grace and truth. I'll read to you the beginning of John 2, and then we'll unpack it a little bit more. It begins like this. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee, and Jesus' mother was there. And Jesus and his disciples also had been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." For some of us, this is a well-known story. And for those of you who may not be as familiar, this is the account of Jesus' first miracle, where he was at a wedding and they ran out of wine, as we just said. And the miracle is that he changed water into wine, like really great wine. And part of the intrigue of this account is the exchange that Jesus has with his mother. Mary informs him that the wine has run out and they are just 3 days into this wedding. And traditionally, these weddings could take 5 to 7 days and the whole town is invited. Now, I know we tend to picture this in contrast to our modern context as being in a, you know, modern reception hall and thinking if something runs out, well, it's a shame that they ran out of the ribeye and garlic potatoes, but I guess I'll have the chicken and mixed vegetables. It's not like that at all. And you might even be thinking, like, if you're a preacher type, if Jesus was a modern day preacher and Mary came to them saying they ran out of wine, great, I'll preach for the rest of the week. But that's not what happens either. Jesus understands the context. Again, it's a week-long party, and for practical purposes, they ran out of the means to continue the celebration. It's not just about wine. It's about family and honor and hosting and celebrating and relationship. In actuality, this family running out of wine is an absolute social disaster. It is utter humiliation for them, especially because Cana is in a small town. They might never live this down. So let's test this idea that John gives us about Jesus, about being a person of grace and truth. At first glance, when Mary tells Jesus that their friends have run out of wine, "Can you help?" Naturally, he says, "My pleasure." No, he doesn't say that. He says, "Dear woman, why do you involve me?" in certain translations. And we might suspect an annoyance with his mother using the term "woman" in the original language. Well, that's actually a term of endearment. And other translations have inserted the adjective "dear" to make sure that we understand that. Dear woman. And Jesus questioning his involvement isn't annoyance. But when he talks about his hour coming, he's talking about the beginning and the continuation of his kingdom ministry and his mission here in this world. But as the text indicates, they both know that he will be involved. Hence, the non-answer that Mary gives back to him and the instructions that she gives to the workers of the wedding. Do whatever he tells you to do. In fact, we might consider this to be a faith story involving Mary. But that's for another time. Let's keep this moving. Jesus instructs them, the workers, to fill these giant water jars that were there for ceremonial cleansing. And it's not there for drinking water. Now, don't miss our friend John, the artist here, including details of the water jars for ceremonial washing. He is showing us that Jesus is going to do a new thing from within the old Jewish system. He is going to be bringing salvation to Israel and the world in a radical and beautiful and new way. The host of the banquet tastes this wine and is so impressed that he makes a declaration that the family has saved the best wine for last. What was about to be an enormous social disgrace has actually been turned around by Jesus to the family receiving even more honor. And now there's more joy. Now there's more celebration. Let's revisit again Jesus being full of grace. If grace is the redemptive work that only God can do, then only Jesus could have changed the water to wine. And the truth, the redemptive message here is that in God's kingdom, is not just about saving a family's reputation, but it's about God's provision. God's provision is greater than anything that can be found in this world. God's provision is greater than anything that can be found in this world. Oh, one more thing. Did you catch the part that this happened on the third day of the wedding feast? I mean, is that a coincidence? No. This is John, the artist, subtly putting it out there that Jesus tends to do his best work on the third day. Ever wonder why Jesus has to make the best wine? Why not make the same wine that they just had and just keep a low profile? Why not change the water into Coca-Cola and launch a new billion-dollar industry? Jesus, full of grace and truth, is doing the work that only he can do and proclaiming a truth that God's provision is greater than anything that can be found in this world. And this is exactly Jesus, one who lives with a rhythm of grace and truth. That's an easy story about how Jesus at the wedding, but how about a harder story? Like when in the very next section, Jesus clearing the temple. Notice the gospel writing artist friend John putting these two stories together. One that happens in the beginning of Jesus' ministry and one that happens towards the end of Jesus' ministry and shortly before being arrested and then crucified. For a long time, I've read numerous commentaries on why he puts these two stories together. Some say Jesus may have done this twice, like clearing the temple twice. Others say because he wants to connect the beginning of the ministry with the end of the ministry. Sure, maybe. Those are reasons, and there are many more speculations. But the best answer I've ever come across is, listen, John is an artist. Back to Jesus clearing the temple. It reads like this. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem in the temple courts. He found people selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and drove all of them from the temple courts, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins and the money changed and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a market." His disciples remembered that it is written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." The Jews then responded to him, "What sign can you show us to prove your authority to do this?" And Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple and I will raise it again in 3 days." They replied, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple. And you're going to raise it in 3 days?" But the temple that he had spoken of was his body. And after he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. And then they believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. Well, what's happening here? There is injustice and corruption. Shady business people ripping off worshipers. And they have turned this whole thing into a business scheme. Now, a few cautions. There are always a small business operation selling animals for sacrifice to workers. There is, you know, this is one Jewish worshiper helping another. And of course, they're providing an animal that needs to be sacrificed. And so they need to be compensated fairly for that work. So paying people fairly for needed work is a good thing. But that's not what's happening here. There was exploitation. There was competition. There was dishonest scales. And this was not about providing help for worshipers, but about making money off of them and profiting unjustly off of the name of God. And the establishment seemed to be in on it. And that's why these crooked money changers were permitted to just be there. Jesus, full of grace and truth, is on rhythm here again. The grace part is in the redemptive work that only the Lord can do. Declaring the temple and clearing it out, declaring it as unclean and clearing it out and restoring its integrity for the Passover for the worshipers of God in that year. Also, I just want to make a secondary comment here. It's fair to point out the restraint that Jesus actually has for the crooked salesmen and money changers. As we've seen in the account, when he's driving people away, no person is actually harmed. They just got to go. The truth part is in the redemptive message that through Jesus' death and resurrection, He is the new temple. Now, this is highly symbolic. Whereas people before came for forgiveness to this earthly temple in the center of Jerusalem and offered a sacrifice, now all will come to Jesus for forgiveness. He's going to be the new center through His ultimate sacrifice. Had Jesus used like the reduced definitions of grace, like being nicer, He would never have accomplished what He did. And had truth just been about saying it how it was, again, He wouldn't have gotten that far. They would have just gotten into more arguments. In fact, had Jesus used the nicest and had just used niceties and said my pleasure to this and to the ways of the misguided religious leaders, He would have avoided the truth, and the crooked money changers would have had their way, and they would have and Jesus probably would have lived a nice long life. They may have even cut Him in on some of the action, but Jesus didn't do that. There is Jesus bringing the truth of the kingdom, confronting injustice, restoring the temple for a place of true worship, and setting the stage again for His ultimate sacrifice. Grace isn't just about being nice. It's the work that only the Lord can do. Truth isn't just telling it like it is. Truth is the redemptive message of the kingdom. Which brings us back to us as we live our lives in search of rhythm, in search of beauty, in search of order. We all know that these are indeed extraordinary times that we're living in. Every conversation, every headline and social media update feels like a potential debate that you are about to be drawn into. Words and symbols and moments are interpreted in different ways to different people. Confrontation often awaits us, and division feels imminent. And mutual conclusions are so hard to reach. Our options of hiding our pain or smiling through our anger and mumbling a nicety through our frustration gives us no pleasure at all. And shouting your truth like it is versus someone else who's doing the exact same thing hasn't accomplished much for us as well. So either sitting silent or being overly polite feels futile, and screaming out the truth at each other is also just as futile. What do we do? Where do we look? Again, to the example of Jesus, to the one who is full of grace and full of truth. Again, grace being the work that only the Lord can do, and truth being the redemptive message of the kingdom. So where do we need to live out some of these rhythms in our everyday lives? I mentioned back in the introduction that many of us feel this tension of just being nice or saying it like it is when it comes to some serious conversations like political or societal matters or even theological ones. Friends, now more than ever, I believe that it won't be someone's great rhetoric that will win these many ideological battles. We've come to a point where disagreement is no longer an exchange of our incomplete truths, piecing the pieces together in hopes that we find a bigger picture together. Instead, it's often a breaking of fellowship when we have disagreements. And we grieve this. Many of us have lost friends and have injured other relationships over these disagreements. Many of us have been extremely careful, and this has still happened. Relationships have been injured, and you find yourself wondering if things will ever be the same again. I know I've been hurt and astounded and angered and so on. And I know others have felt similar by me and maybe by you in their own right. And this has left us with numerous times of avoiding conversations with someone that you might care about or someone that you want to get to know better, because the last time there was a similar conversation, it got either ugly or awkward or painful. So now in avoidance, we talk about what might feel like every trivial matter out there because it feels safer. It's just like saying my pleasure over and over and over, even out of context, just to avoid potentially creating any further pain or discomfort or worse. the fracturing of another relationship. What I've become convinced of is that no amount of reading and becoming ultimately informed will change this. I've become convinced that we must depend on the grace of God. And again, that is the work that only the Lord can do. To change hearts, only the way that He can change. To change my heart, only the work that He can do. And the positions I hold, the conclusions I reach, must be rooted ultimately in the truth of Jesus, as in the redemptive message of the kingdom. You might be thinking, great, I'm already doing that. I hope so. But just, it would be good for us all to remember that 2,000 years ago, the religious folks then truly believed they were already doing that, honoring God the Father, obeying the law of Moses, and so on. And they completely missed the Son of God standing right in front of them. In fact, not only did they miss Him or just ignore Him, but they were so offended by His message that they killed Him over it. Jesus turned the whole world upside down. The truth of Jesus might turn our world upside down as well. Because Jesus was able to bring both grace and truth in His interactions. There was redemptive and a transformative kingdom outcome. Because He was able to give grace and truth, there was a redemptive and transformative kingdom outcome. Grace without truth may not call people to something better. And truth without grace doesn't give people the freedom to change and grow. But together in the way of Jesus, they can change our lives and the lives around us. I mentioned earlier that we were approaching that time of year when hopefully we'll be gathering with loved ones again. This year, maybe a few more will be gathering around your table than last year, and or maybe many, many more. Maybe Thanksgiving will look like previous years, but maybe instead of running out of wine or turkey, what if the disaster is that we realize that we have run out of that relational trust with one another? Could we look to Jesus to change the emptiness into fullness? Could we look to Jesus to resurrect these needed and wonderful relationships? Could we look to Jesus to drive out the corruption and the greed and the potential self-righteousness in our hearts, and for Jesus to do the work of grace that only He can do, to revolutionize our lives with the redemptive message of His kingdom hope? That is the rhythm that we need. To live like Jesus, we need to pursue a life full of grace and truth. That rhythm of grace and truth will bring us beauty and order and love and hope and healing and reconciliation to the Lord and to each other. That rhythm of Jesus is what we long for in these challenging days. It's that rhythm of grace and truth that we pray will not only be an inspiration to our world, but will actually bring salvation and redemption to our world. And so, my friends, may our hearts be like Jesus, full of grace and truth. Amen and amen.